This is the first day of this September two-day Sesshin 2013. And we're going to take passages from several sources. And we're going to start with, those sources will be three actually. Daido Lori, who is the abbot of the Zen Mountain Monastery in the Catskills. He died a couple of years ago, actually maybe more than a couple. And then Stephen Batchelor, a British Zen teacher, trained initially in the Tibetan and then in the Korean school of Zen. And then Sheng Yan, our Chinese heritage teacher, who he died in 2009. I'm going to start out with faith, because without faith, there really isn't an ability to do this practice. Faith is really, you could say, it's confidence. Confidence in something, in the truth, something that can't be logically proven. And when we do Zen or we do meditation, we're really in that not knowing phase. So faith is this mind of openness and wonder to something we intuit, but we don't yet apprehend. It is a mind of confidence, and what we find as we practice is actually personal confidence grows. You might think, because this is an ego wearing away practice, that you would become more wobbly than one is at the start. You would become less confident, but in fact the opposite happens. We become more upright, more grounded, and more sure of our innate perfection. It's not by chance that when, I can't remember which master came to awakening, he just said, my eyes are, get it right, horizontal and my nose is vertical. Confidence in this very body-mind that we're all, that we are here with. Faith is actually considered one of the three requisites for awakening. Great faith, great doubt, and great effort. The one leads to the other. Of course, the faith part of it is really grounded in what the Buddha understood and experienced, and therefore, and it's who we are. You can't, as Bodhidharma says, you can't look for, if you're looking for a Buddha outside yourself, you'll never find it, because the Buddha is you, it's us, it's within. So we have this inherent grounding in it, but because we haven't maybe fully realized it, we have to have this confidence in something that can't be logically worked out. Sheng Yan, the Taiwanese Chinese Zen master who was born in 1930, died in 2009, he says about this in his book Shattering the Great Doubt. To successfully practice Chan or Zen, you need more than just the method of meditation. You should also have the proper attitudes. You should have faith and confidence. You should make vows. You should have a compassionate heart. And you should cultivate renunciation. These are fundamental. This is why it's not just one, sitting there with our Zazen, doing our thing. These other aspects, making vows. I vow to save all sentient beings. This is what it's about. I vow to have a compassionate heart. I vow to give up all of those annoying habits I have or the harm that I do to others. These are a fundamental part of this training that we undertake. And Sashin actually offers us all those opportunities to incorporate this balance into our essential bedrock of what we're doing, which is the Zazen. He goes on, all religions are established on faith. Chan faith is primarily in yourself. I'll use the word Chan here with him because he's Chinese. That is the Chinese word for Zen. Chan faith is primarily in yourself. You should believe that you have good karmic roots and that you have the potential to become enlightened. If you do not have this kind of faith, you can be easily deterred as soon as you encounter obstacles, and you'll think you're not suitable for this practice. Therefore, it is most important to have faith in yourself. And we will encounter obstacles. Life is full of obstacles. Everything is up and down. One day we have great news, the next day we have sad news or difficult things. We hurt people, they hurt us. We have all kinds of memories and things that have happened in our lives. But the virtue of the practice is that we are more and more able, as we stabilize and get this confidence, and we are more and more able to embrace those things that come to us. We live basically in our reality instead of trying to avoid what's happening to us by various other means that we have. In the recent Zenbo, most people have maybe read it already, but quite a lot of people may not, so I would like to include the little story about faith, actually, that Richard von Stürmer, who is the head of Zendo in Auckland, husband to Amala Sensei, that he included in his little article in the latest version. And it's the story, true story, of a football player with a head injury. Here it is. Two British teams were battling out a championship match. This is soccer, of course. The final whistle was not far off, and they were still tied. When one player collided with another and fell, out cold, a stretcher carried him off, and the entire medical team went to work, but the man did not come to. Minutes passed, and the coach was swallowing the clock, hands and all. He had already used up his substitutions. His boys, 10 against 11, were defending as best they could, which was not much. The coach could see defeat coming, when suddenly the team doctor ran up and cried ecstatically, "We did it! He's coming around!" And in a low voice he added, "He doesn't know who he is." The coach went over to the player, who was babbling incoherently as he tried to get to his feet, and in his ear informed him, "You are Pele." They won the match 5-0. The Brazilian Pelé is considered to be the greatest soccer player in the history of the game. Well, nobody's whispered "you are Pelé" in our ears, but we have, in some sense, heard that whisper, which brings us to practice. And this great faith is what carries us through our long association with practice. Shengyan then goes on, second, you should have faith in the Dharma. You should believe that practicing Dharma will illuminate your mind and allow you to experience your true nature. Without faith in the Dharma, you will not be able to accept it, much less cultivate it. This Dharma includes the method of practice as transmitted by a teacher and spoken originally by the Buddha. So to establish confidence in the Dharma, you should first have confidence in the teacher. We're lucky, we have a really fine, fine teacher in Roshi Bodhin. And maintaining that confidence in the teacher over a lifetime of practice is challenging. The Roshi is dedicated to taking away our sticky parts, our notions, and this practice does the same thing. He spoke about that too in this recent article. But having a teacher who's gone on this path before is what will help us to stay on the road. In Faith to Doubt, Stephen Batchelor, that's the British teacher who started out in the Tibetan tradition and then went to Korea and was Sunam Kusim's student, he says this about faith. The mysterious lies at the heart of our lives, not at the periphery, and its presence is only felt to the extent that a meditative attitude still lives within us. Unlike a problem, a mystery can never be solved. A mystery can only be penetrated. A problem once solved ceases to be a problem, but the penetration of a mystery does not make it any less mysterious. The more intimate one is with a mystery, the greater shines the aura of its secret. The intensification of a mystery leads not to frustration, as with an unsolved problem, but to release. And we could say in the case of our practice, it leads to uncovering our true nature. He goes on. The practice of meditation is a process of attrition. The mind has a seemingly infinite capacity for chatter, and there is no easy cure for this proliferation of thoughts and emotions. Only the patient continuity of meditation, what the Chinese master Xu Yun, that's empty cloud, called, quote, a long enduring mind, can finally wear it down. Meditation is closer to the valleys than the peaks. A meditative attitude is not preoccupied with peak experiences, those exhilarating heights of spiritual experience that leave the valleys and plains far below. For meditation to stay fertile, it needs the fertile soil of the valley, to follow the humble paths along the valleys amidst the myriad details of daily life. You see, our life is our practice. Most of us here, of course, there are many people on staff who are taking a break in that sense from, the regular life of going out to find a job and so forth. But our life is our practice. It's not that we come and do a sesshin and we, get recharged and we go out and we come once a week or we come every day to the center and we go out there and then just do it in the Zendo. It is our daily life. And that's our practice. And we have to learn and develop an ability to bring it into our daily life. And actually, patience is a key here. Patience is transformative. And certainly we learn it in Sesshin. It's transformative because it accords really with reality. It's not looking for results. It's staying with it. I think actually about researchers. I think of my elder sister who has spent decades looking at Schwann cells. Now, Schwann cells, just one little important part of the nervous system with the conduction of nerve impulses. Decades of dealing with Schwann cells, no tangible big result, just keep on looking. Eventually, if they can solve the mystery of the Schwann cell, we'll be able to have paraplegics walking, we'll be able to restore nerve injuries, but that's not where the effort and the guts of it is. It's just looking there. Think of Nelson Mandela, all those incredible years spent on Robert's Island, imprisoned and mistreated, and with enormous patience taking it on and really transforming not only his own ability but those of the guards who took care of him. Think of Deborah Zaretsky enduring an incredible illness, repeated over and over, going to the hospital, and but this is an important issue to understand. The three pillars of Zen gives us great encouragement and insight into enlightenment experiences. The euphoria of suddenly released from years of practice, of not knowing, and so forth. But we mustn't confuse it for what the basic element of our work is, which is to stay in the valleys, to develop, to come to awakening through our repeated cleansing and work. There's a tendency to only want to give recognition to those who have it. Well, that's a mistaken view. The people who stick with this through years and years and years, they become very refined. They have the grace. They've lost a lot of their ego, and they are great examples. In fact, in the Soto tradition, this enlightenment experience is not considered a central part of the practice. So patience comes back to us as a necessity and as a gift too. You know, the poet Rilke said of it, he says, Roshi sometimes reads this at the end of a sesshin, but he said, Rilke says, "Do not measure in terms of time. 1 year or 10 years means nothing. For the artist, there is no counting or tallying, just ripening like the tree that does not force its sap and endures the storms of spring without fearing that summer will never come. It comes, however, but only to the patient, one who stands there as if all eternity lay before him, vast, still, untroubled. I learn this every day of my life. I learn it from hardships. I am grateful, for patience is all." Could be said that most of us have experiences in our lives which come unexpectedly, many times as children, moments of insight that remain true regardless of the age they were experienced at. Such experiences are not, in fact, unusual, and especially in cultures where mystery and unknowing is valued. And in our own culture, such experiences have also been sought through mind-altering drugs. And we tend to cling to these experiences because they have, or they are, the taste of the divine. But there's a word of caution here, and Stephen Batchelor puts it quite well. "One of the greatest dangers of all lies in the recollection of our own experiences in meditation. It is not so unusual to awaken to something extraordinary and unprecedented, but the more unusual and mystical is the experience, the greater will be the danger. For we will be tempted, once the immediate experience has faded, to place an image of it before us and then strive to recapture it. Once this happens and we confidently proceed under the illusion that the unpredictable will from now on conform to our well-founded expectations, then genuine meditative questioning is lost. Thus, the beginner has a great advantage over the experienced meditator. So people for whom this is the first sesshin can take heart that if you don't know what you're doing, if you wonder why you came, if you have no sense much of how this is all going to work out, you're in good shape here. And for us people who've been doing this a long time, we have to leave such experience behind. If they were true insights, they will have been transformative, and it will appear in us in a shift of consciousness. We may be a little clearer, a little less egotistical, more compassionate, less separated, better listener, be more present in our lives. And, dwelling in the past, which is what that is when you keep bringing up past experiences, prevents us from being in the state of awareness in the present. And really, as we all know, is the only moment that we can experience awakening. Stephen Batchelor continues, meditation does not add anything to life. It recovers what has been lost. There's that cute story of, apparently true, and I'm sure I'll get it all muddled up. Wayman knows the better version of it, but I'll just give you the rough outline. This little boy who asks his mom and dad if he can go and talk to his little brother, a new baby. And they're a bit worried because he, 3-year-olds aren't necessarily going to be great with a new little sibling. But he begs and begs, and finally they say, okay, but just a little while now, and be nice to your little brother. And so he goes in there, and of course, anxious as parents often are, they listen at the door. And he says to his little brother, tell me what God looks like, because I'm starting to forget. This sense of the divine is just fundamental to us, our true nature, but it's been obscured by our infatuation with ourselves as a separate ego. Batchelor says, with endless calculations and melodramas. And all our melodramas have ourselves as the central character. Actually, we spend our lives creating a universe in our heads, and we're always on stage. Self-concern is our disease. And fortunately, meditation is the medication. If you could use a computer analogy, you could think of a screensaver. Most of us have a favorite thing on our screensaver. Might be a picture of someone we love, beautiful landscape we remember, cute child or a pet or Godzilla, who knows. But ours tends to be a self-portrait. And just as in the computer, when you turn off the function of awareness to the task at hand and the screensaver comes up and fills the whole screen, it's called the default mode network in modern neuroscience, and it's the self-referencing part of the brain that can actually be identified in scans. And in long-term meditators, 10,000 to 20,000 hours, the screensaver simply doesn't come up anymore. The mind has thoughts when it needs to think, but otherwise it rests in its fundamental mode of silence. And meditation is the practice of returning to this fundamental silence by letting go of the words in our heads and the mental pictures in our heads. Ramana Maharshi, the great Indian teacher of this century, died in the 80s. He says this: remaining quiet is what is called wisdom insight. To remain quiet is to resolve the mind in the self, that means in the true nature. Thus, there is a state where words cease and silence prevails. Silence is the ocean into which all the rivers of all the religions discharge themselves. What one fails to know by conversation extending several years can be known in a trice in silence. From silence comes thought, from thought the ego, from ego speech. So if speech is effective, how much more so must be its source? Every name and form is the cause of trouble. Thoughts are the enemy. Thoughts amount to the creation of the universe. Give up thoughts and you need not give up anything else. Your duty is to be and not to be this or that. Freedom is only knowing the true self. Concentrate and you will get it. Of course, first, when we first start practicing, we aren't really able to see that this thoughting that goes on in our minds, these hundreds of fleeting impressions and conversations and judgments, and that they're actually a surface phenomenon on our mind. They're not the whole thing. So it takes a lot of meditation to begin to see thoughts as they come into the mind and to be able to disengage from them and let them go. According to research, most of us would have 80,000 thoughts a day. And so to imagine that we could get rid of those just by, you know, a couple of hours of meditation, whatever, it's unrealistic. The brain excretes thoughts in response to any kind of stimulus. So we're not trying to stop the brain from doing what it does, because you can't, but we find another way through concentration to just let the thoughts settle all by themselves. After a while, we do begin to see the thoughts, or we recognize that we're having a thought. And this could be depressing, but it really should be a source of great not quite happiness, but to notice that you're having a thought is really the only way to bring yourself back to not having a thought, to back to the practice, back to the concentration. So rather than getting frustrated by it, we say, oh, okay, have another thought, back, always back on the practice. And this concentration is the key. Dido Luri, who's the abbot of Zen Mountain Monastery, in his book, Two Arrows Meeting in Midair, he says this about this process of quietening the mind. Little by little, through the process of Zazen, we learn to quiet our internal dialogue, that incessant conversation that we have with ourselves. Gradually, we are able to put our awareness on the breath. The breath is just one of the many points of focus used in meditation. But Zazen is more than just meditation. It's more than just stilling the mind. Zazen is the manifestation of our life. It is everything we do that's fully present, alert, and aware in the moment. In the process of working with our thoughts, acknowledging them, letting them go, and coming back again to the breath, or the koan, we begin to develop what's called joriki, or self-power. Juriki is the direct result of letting go of thoughts and bringing awareness back to the breath. Each time you do that, you strengthen your concentration. Through Zazen, the whole body and mind are involved in Juriki. Juriki is of vital importance in preparing yourself for awakening, and certainly for work on a koan, because it enables you to put your mind where you want it, when you want it there, for as long as you want it there. Juriki eventually becomes what we call samadhi, or single-pointedness of mind. Zazen continuously nurtures our samadhi, providing the pivotal foundation for engaging in the koan. In frustrating the intellect, koans dismantle the customary way of solving problems and open up new dimensions of human consciousness. Our means of answering questions depends on what has been successful in the past. All through our lives and education, we've been taught to use our minds in a linear and sequential way. That's the way we measure IQ. That's the way we pass exams, solve problems and riddles, and work our way to success. If you have a good intellect and analytical talent, chances are good that you've moved very high in whatever field you're working in. When it comes to the creative process and spiritual questions, a whole different kind of consciousness is involved. That consciousness is not linear or sequential. All of us possess it. All of us possess it. Somehow our education is minimized or completely excluded, and it's very limiting in our lives. The process of Zazen is a never-ending, ceaseless activity of self-inquiry. It has to do with turning inward. What's critical in the process of studying the self is not holding on to anything. If there are unresolved aspects of yourself, if there are suppressed issues or tensions, they need to come to the surface before you can handle the realization of who you are and what your life is. You can't push them out of the way, and Zen training is designed to make that impossible. Beginning sitters for the first time in their lives have an opportunity to really listen to themselves. During our everyday lives, we don't realize that we are engaged in a constant internal conversation. We talk to ourselves all the time. We are preoccupied as we comment, analyze, judge, reflect, evaluate, systemize, categorize, name. All of that is perpetually going on, and there is no space to experience now, to experience the moment. Zazen gives us access to our monologue and the means to see through it. People starting Zazen usually come to Dokusan stunned at how active their minds are, convinced that they are the only ones in the world who experience this phenomenon. We all do it. We all distract ourselves. In Zazen, the internal dialogue starts to slow down. This happens by persistent work with the thoughts as they come up. You notice them, let them go, then come back again to the breath. Again and again. Once in a while, something very significant comes up and you need to attend to that. Something is happening in your life. It's not just noise. It's not just random thought. It's crucial. It has to do with relationship, grief, decisions. When you let it go, it comes right back again. And he says that if something like this is occurring, it is a signal to process it exhaustively, not to push it aside or ignore it. We'll come back to that later, actually. Meticulous effort, he says, is necessary for effective koan work, or breath work even. What is meticulous effort? How do you exert it? It means attention to detail as well as with handling global awareness. It doesn't necessarily mean a lot of grunting and groaning. It depends on student personality. You know there's an answer. You have faith that there's an answer. You know hundreds of other people have seen it, so you persevere. You keep trying. You keep getting rejected and thrown back on yourself. Doubt becomes greater. It begins to shake up the solidity that you think you've developed. And finally, the whole intellectual process gets frustrated to the extreme, and you make the quantum leap. You suddenly see it as if out of the blue. What is significant here is this sentence, you know hundreds of other people have seen it, so you persevere, you keep trying. It's, we can all do this. In the common parlance, it's not rocket science. It's something, it's uncovering something in ourselves. So you just persevere, you keep trying, and you'll get there. I mean, people think that even working on koans, you get stuck on a koan, say, oh, I'll never get this. This is ridiculous. Never. And you do, because you keep trying and you keep working at it, and eventually you can do it. These people who've done it, they aren't that special. You know that. We know that. So have the faith that with the perseverance, you suddenly see it as if out of the blue. Stephen Batchelor says about this, with no idea or picture of what might happen, we simply have to wait. No amount of experience will predict the ways in which the mysterious will unfold. In waiting, as in unknowing, we cannot resort to our stores of accumulated knowledge. But in leaving them behind, we enter not into a blank state of indifference, but one of vivid, unprejudiced questioning. T.S. Eliot, in the Four Quartets, I said to my soul, be still and wait without hope, for hope would be hope for the wrong thing. Wait without love, for love would be love of the wrong thing. There is yet faith, but the faith and the hope and the love are all in the waiting. Wait without thought, for you are not yet ready for thought, so the darkness shall be the light, and the stillness, the dancing. Meditative awareness listens. It is receptive to whatever occurs, just as our ears are receptive to the ever-present symphony of sound and silence that engulfs us. In the simplicity of waiting, why not listen for the footfall of the mysterious, then look for a visionary sign? Wayman gave a little talk in the Zendo here in Batavia a couple of weeks ago. He and Dwayne and Jim Thompson go to the state prison at Attica and have a meditation group there. And Dwayne recounted a story about Mother Teresa, the Catholic nun who worked decades in the slums of Calcutta. And she was interviewed by a very well-known reporter and who asked if she prayed a lot. And she replied, yeah, I pray often. So the reporter says, well, what do you ask God for? And she said, I don't ask for anything. I just listen. And the reporter said, so, what does God say to you? He just listens too. So we're going to stop pretty soon here. We can use sound here in this Zendo to bring ourselves back to awareness, back to the practice, back to the breath or the koan, whatever we're working on, what am I, all of those practices. The crickets, sometimes the quarry, you can hear the rattling of the stones, the stick, our own breath. And we just use this as a way to bring ourselves back to this concentration, back to this building of our jariki, and the rest is up to us. Each one of us treads this path by ourselves, with the help of teachers, help of others, supported here in a sesshin by 40-some people, all just pouring out their effort and their heart. And we can use this to really, in a two-day, it seems like, I mean, we always talk in a seven-day, first 2 days are such a grind, you know, and nobody expects anything. But that's really cutting ourselves short, because in this short period of time, all together, working together, we can actually really, really dive deeply into this marvelous heritage, this true nature of ours. And we'll stop here now and recite the four vows.